This is BBC Radio 3. It's 8 o'clock, time now for this evening's prom. And there's, incidentally, a new way to listen to live proms via an extra high-quality audio stream on the proms website. That's at bbc.co.uk/proms. So let's join Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall in London.
Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the climax of Henry Wood Day here at the Proms, celebrating the founder and conductor of this extraordinary festival and his vision of bringing the best and newest classical music to the widest possible audience. This evening we're going to hear pieces with Wood's personal stamp all over them, works directly connected with him and music by some of the composers he championed. And there's even a belated Proms premiere for a fanfare by Sir Arthur Bliss, written for Henry Wood's 75th birthday in 1944, the year he died. The Ulster Orchestra is here to play music from Bach's to Tchaikovsky, and they'll be joined before the interval by pianist Stephen Osborne to play a concerto Henry Wood introduced to the UK at the Proms 110 years ago, Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto. This evening's conductor is a veteran of many Proms himself, as a former principal cellist in the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Paul Watkins, who seems to have become quite a fan of Sir Henry.
What I think I really admire him for is that he was also a champion of completely unknown composers. I think Dorothy Howe is a great case in point. You know, a young girl of 20, 21, I think she was, an up-and-coming solo pianist, but wrote this absolutely wonderful piece. And he could see the quality and hear the quality straight away, jumped on the piece, premiered it at the Proms, gave her overnight celebrity, and then took it around the country. And I think he must have been a very, very generous spirit, actually.
Paul Watkins, former principal cellist of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, back at the Proms this evening to conduct the Ulster Orchestra, and we'll be hearing Dorothy Howell's symphonic poem Lamia in the first half of the concert. We'll also be hearing them in the London Pageant by Arnold Bax, written ahead of King George VI's coronation in May 1937, and it had its first concert performance at the last night of the Proms that same year, conducted by Henry Wood, when the programme described it as a vivid musical picture of the fervour and excitement of London at the time of the coronation. But that applause is for Paul Watkins to conduct the Ulster Orchestra in Arthur Bliss's birthday fanfare for Sir Henry Wood. Arthur Bliss's birthday fanfare for Sir Henry Wood. And in just a moment, we're going to hear Bax's London Pageant.
Thank you.
Music inspired by the imminent coronation of King George VI in 1937. Arnold Bax's London Pageant. Premiered in a BBC broadcast a week before the coronation, conducted by Albert Coates, but given its first concert performance on the last night of the proms that same October, conducted by the man whose influence on British musical life we're celebrating today, Sir Henry Wood. And we've just heard it performed by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins. Well, the next music we're going to hear shows Henry Wood's sense of adventure in programming music for his promenade concerts. Lamia, a symphonic poem by a young pianist from Birmingham, Dorothy Howell, just 21 when Wood conducted its first performance at the Queen's Hall in 1919. Dorothy Howell already had a reputation as a pianist, and her composition teacher J.B. McEwen suggested she send her new piece to Wood, who seems to have had no hesitation in trying it out on the promenaders at the earliest opportunity. His instincts were spot on. It was acclaimed by audience and critics, and Wood brought Lamia back to the proms another 8 times before the last time it was heard here back in 1940. Well, the subject of Dorothy Howell's symphonic poem is from Greek mythology, retold in a poem by Keats. Lamia is a woman trapped in the shape of a serpent, discovered by the god Hermes, living in the forest in Crete and longing for the love of a handsome young Corinthian, Lysias, who haunts her dreams. Hermes takes pity on her and gives her human form so that she can go in search of him. And when Lamia finds him, he falls for her. They disappear together to live in secret. But after their love scene and a passionate climax, the music reveals that this is not to be a happy ever after scenario. Against Lamia's better judgment, Lysias persuades her to marry him in public. And at the wedding feast, she's recognized by her former tutor, who denounces Lamia as a serpent to the assembled guests. With a shriek, she becomes a snake again.
Thank you.
hushed recollections of a love scene ending Lamia, the symphonic poem by Dorothy Howell, the 21-year-old pianist-composer whose piece was premiered to considerable acclaim by Sir Henry Wood at the Proms in September 1919. The Star newspaper reporting that all musical London is talking about Miss Dorothy Howell, the girl composer whose symphonic poem Lamia created such an instantaneous effect at the Queen's Hall. Last performed by Wood at a Promenade concert in 1940. And we just heard it performed by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins. Well, we've just heard them reintroducing a work to the Proms almost 90 years after Henry Wood gave the first performance, but the next work we're going to hear has had considerably more exposure since Wood presided over its first British performance at the Proms back in 1900, Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1. And perhaps we should look at the context for that Proms premiere 110 years ago. Rachmaninoff was still only 27, well established as a brilliant pianist, much less so as a composer. Henry Wood was just 4 years older than Rachmaninoff. He was to continue to champion the younger man's music, conducting the first English performance of The Isle of the Dead in 1915, programming performances of all three Rachmaninoff piano concertos, and regularly introducing his own orchestration of a Rachmaninoff prelude, which became something of a Henry Wood Proms party piece. For this evening's performance of Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto, the Ulster Orchestra is joined by Stephen Osborne. And earlier, we were musing on why the first concerto wasn't played more often.
I think it's probably that the melodies are slightly more elusive, particularly in the last movement. It's very difficult to actually cotton on to anything that's a really clear tune. There's a little burst of some kind of a little dance thing that comes within the first minute, but apart from that, it's lots of figuration and virtuosic things. I mean, it's incredibly fun to play and it's great to listen to it, but it doesn't have the kind of things you have in the second or third concertos where immediately you have some fantastic tunes to latch onto, and let's face it, everyone likes tunes.
But does it already give you a real sense of Rachmaninoff the pianist, the kind of player he was?
Yeah, I mean, it's rather interesting, even given the time that he revised it, which was after he'd written the second concerto, even after the third, the piano style that he uses is relatively spare, because in the other concertos there's a lot of contrapuntal stuff that goes on within the hands, like very, very complex figurations. In this one it's more simple. I mean, in keeping with the sort of model of Grieg, which is what he started with, it's not sort of overwritten as it easily could have been.
And what about the sense of improvisation? Is there any of that about the piece, the feeling of Rachmaninoff just sort of seeing where something wants to go at the piano, experimenting?
Yeah, particularly there's a spot in the last movement where he sort of suddenly departs from where the form seems to be going, just has this sort of solo piano sort of reverie, which meanders around for a bit, and the orchestra gradually joins in, and then after a while we get back to the material.
Now, show me your hand. Yeah, there's a photo in the programme book tonight, that famous photo of Rachmaninoff's hands over the keyboard, and, you know, we know they're enormous.
Yeah.
How much does that actually make an impact on what's in front of you when you play the concerto?
The place where it's really the most obvious is in some of the solo works, where he has chords which are absolutely unplayable for just about anyone else. So in those cases you just decide what you're going to leave out, because, you know, it's, if you really try and play everything that's there, it sounds so laboured, you know, you're having to spread lots of chords and you can't play the phrases as you would feel them.
But this one fits within your span?
Pretty much.
This evening's soloist Stephen Osborne talking to me earlier. Rachmaninoff must have been grateful for Henry Wood's enthusiasm for his music. He was the star performer at Wood's Jubilee concert here in the Royal Albert Hall in October 1938, and apparently Vaughan Williams' Serenade to Music, commissioned for the concert, reduced Rachmaninoff to tears. And also, in the second half of that concert, was one of the works we've already heard this evening, Bax's London Pageant. Well, the Ulster Orchestra's tune. Courtesy of leader Mr. Kocsis, and here comes Stephen Osborne with conductor Paul Watkins to join the Ulster Orchestra for Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 1, the composer's revised version from 1970.
Thank you. Thank you.
the thrilling ending of the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Sergei Rachmaninoff, a work given its British premiere 110 years ago under the baton of Sir Henry Wood at one of his promenade concerts at the Queen's Hall in London. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, we've just heard it played by Stephen Osborne with the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins. And off they go, Paul Watkins almost trotting after the soloist as he strides from the stage. I mentioned Rachmaninoff's appearance at Sir Henry's Jubilee concert here in October 1938. Rachmaninoff played his own second concerto in the first part, and the Royal Academy of Music in London actually has a fine photo of the occasion taken from an arena promenader's point of view from the look of it, Wood leaning down from the podium to shake Rachmaninoff's hand. And back on stage now, alone this time, comes Stephen Osborne, turning to applaud the players of the Ulster Orchestra, who remain seated, clapping him, tapping their bows on the music to show their appreciation for his performance. Stephen Osborne's just down from Edinburgh and a solo recital at the festival there last week that had the local critics in a bit of a lather. Scott Joplin, George Gershwin, Charles Ives, George Crumb, jazz preludes by Nikolai Kapustin, and Osborne's own transcription of Oscar Peterson's Indiana. That was before a second half of Rachmaninoff, Ravel, and a Bill Evans encore. A staggering display of versatility, breathtaking in its sweep and verve, said the Herald. Here they come again, Stephen Osborne and Paul Watkins, who brings the Ulster Orchestra to their feet to acknowledge the cheers of the promenaders. And Stephen told me himself that he always loves playing the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh. You can hear his recital, that same recital, for yourself, as it's Radio 3's lunchtime concert this coming Friday at 1 o'clock. And by the way, if you're listening online right now, or you sometimes stream Proms concerts via the internet, then I hope you'll be taking advantage of the new high-quality stream at a higher bitrate. It's just from this weekend until the last night next Saturday. But if you listen on headphones or your computer's wired up to the hi-fi, it's apparently well worth trying. Go to the Proms homepage. You'll see a box right there labelled high-quality listening. See what you think, and do send our boffins some feedback. Well, the second half of this evening's Henry Wood Prom has more of his favourites: Sibelius's Corellia Suite, Hubert Parry's Symphonic Variations, and the Waltz and Polonaise from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin. But that's after our latest visit to the Proms Literary Festival, recorded earlier this evening just across the road at the Royal College of Music. Here's Matthew Sweet.
Hello and welcome to another event in the Proms Literary Festival, in which we put the words to the music surging out of the Albert Hall. Over the road, they've been bending the laws of time in order to have the first last night of the Proms all over again, reviving the lost work of now-forgotten composers such as Dorothy Forster and Amboise Thomas. In this programme, we're going to explore the cultural hinterlands of the people who would have been at the Proms 100 years ago, the novels and plays and films and gallery shows that would have filled their heads and their conversations. So let me introduce you to our three guides with whom we're going to yomp around the salient cultural features of 1910. They are Juliet Gardner, Linda Need, and Juliet Nicholson, three historians of British culture and society. They're going to draw our attention to century-old works that have lost their foothold on posterity. But first, let's try to get a sense of who that audience was in the Queen's Hall, wasn't it, in 1910, Juliet Nicholson. Was this a significantly different experience to the modern prom concert?
Well, the Queen's Hall, which, was bombed in the Second World War and no longer exists, but was just near the BBC in Langham Place, was a wonderful building, painted the colour of the underbelly of a London mouse, a lovely soft grey. And over the orchestra were these huge red lampshades that hung right down. And there was a policy of if you were choosing to smoke a cigarette, not to light a match during the vocals. But there was also a little section apart for the non-smokers. The seats were about half and half, half seated and half for standing up. And it was a hugely fun experience intended to attract all sorts of people.
Now, 1910, I suppose, has come down to us as one of those years that comprise this golden afternoon, this storm before the Great War that's become rather a historical cliche. But, I mean, maybe it would be equally easy to characterise this period, Juliet Gardiner, as one of doubt and anxiety.
Oh, certainly. I mean, I think we always say this, don't we, about every decade, that it was a time of contradictions and contrasts. But I think the Edwardian period, the 1910, and we count the Edwardian period, of course, it's longer than Edward, isn't it, after all, because 1910 is actually, of course, when Edward VII died, having come to the throne in 1901. But I think what the period we're really talking about is up until the First World War. And at one level, yes, it was a golden era. It was a glittering era. But on the other hand, of course, it was a huge, I mean, it was an extremely, there was probably the greatest contrast of all time between the rich and the poor. I mean, if you think that perhaps about three quarters of the wealth in Britain was owned by a tiny percentage of the population, 90% of people who died left no recorded property whatsoever. So I think that gives us some sort of a sense of what a very contrasting and different society it was. And it was also, of course, a society which was both very conservative in some ways, but also very progressive in other ways. It was an absolutely fascinating time. Just like to say one, I always remember that H.G. Wells, when Queen Victoria died, he wrote, it was like lifting up a paperweight. All the papers blew around, non-stop sort of change and different sort of ways of living, different ways of culture, different ways of society.
What are these different ways of living, Lynn Mead? What ideas were in the air? What are people talking about?
Well, I suppose the big idea in cultural terms was modernism. The idea that you no longer had to paint sort of narrative subjects in a realist style, but that drawing on new movements, new artistic movements from the continent, you could explore abstract forms and much more expressive use of lines and colour and composition and so on. And in fact, it was with art in mind that Virginia Woolf said, in or around December 1910, human character changed. You know, for her, 1910 was a real sort of moment of massive change. And what she was thinking about was the exhibition that the art critic Roger Fry organized called Manet and Post-Impressionism. And it was one of the first exhibitions in the Grafton Galleries in London to introduce English audiences to French modernist painters like Cézanne and Matisse. So that's what she thought. She saw social relations changing, and as a result of that, the cultural landscape was changing also.
And Juliet Nicholson, how confident are Britons feeling at this moment about their place in the world?
Well, I think there was a certain sense of invincibility. I mean, the empire was, I think it was 400 million was the number of the... And we hadn't been at war for a very long time. There was the Boer War. But as the sort of sense of being impregnable was very strong. But that is not to say that there wasn't internal differences. And 1910 is very much... after the death of Edward VII and the accession of George V, a time when women, trade unions, servants, the poor, and indeed the rich, who were being very, very severely taxed by Lloyd George, and the rich obviously objecting to it, this 1% that owned 60% of the country that Juliet was referring to. It was a cusp domestically of deep unrest.
I think the other side of empire is the sense of trouble right in the heart of darkness, in the very heart of the empire, in the metropolis. And it was in just this period in 1905 and then later in 1910 that you get the Alien Acts passed, And I mean, this must ring so kind of strongly for us today, which was about concern about immigration, specifically from Eastern Europe, from Russia and the Ukraine and so on, of immigrants into the British Empire who were foreign and strange and politically anarchic, and who seemed to be able to cause trouble right at the heart of the empire. So it wasn't only this vision that was kind of looking outwards, it was also anxiety, related anxiety, about what was right at the heart of the empire.
And these ideas, these anxieties, are reflected in the literature of the period too, aren't they? I mean, Lynn's mentioned anxieties about immigration. This is the year that Conan Doyle wrote The Coming of the Hun. G.K. Chesterton wrote What's Wrong with the World. These debates are legible.
And, of course, Joseph Conrad wrote The Secret Agent, which, you know, is absolutely what Lynn, you know, was talking about, I think.
So what other debates can be legible in the art and the culture of this time? If we were to look for the stresses and strains within Edwardian culture, its debates, where should we go to find them?
Well, there's a very interesting leader in the Times, published on the day before the last night of the proms in 1910, in which the Times, specifically addressing music, because the proms is about to come to an end, says how music seems to have been somehow exempted in the public sensibility from their resistance to change within literature and poetry and painting. And I heard a story from a very old lady who'd known a very old lady who'd been to the post-impressionist exhibition at the Grafton Gallery and had seen people coming out of the gallery being sick in the pavement, you know, because of the shock of this. And so and something about music being not a sort of in some way not figurative. In a novel, you want a story. You don't want Virginia Woolf's stream of consciousness necessarily. It's more difficult to take. In painting, you want something that you recognize. But in music, somebody like Debussy somehow got away with it because these sort of mental restrictions weren't placed so severely on music. That's what the Times felt. And I can follow the argument.
OK, well, let's try and offer a panorama, as it were, of British culture in this period. Down at the Hepworth Film Studios in Surrey, stars such as Chrissy White and Alma Taylor acting under the glass roof stage. The West End is the domain of Ellaline Terrace and Seymour Hicks, whose performances you can listen to online via a phone service that links your handset with the auditorium. Linda, what does the visual culture of this year have to offer?
Well, you could go to the Royal Academy summer exhibition, the annual exhibition, and you would see the usual mix of portraits and landscapes. Landscape as an exploration of Englishness continues alongside, you know, Elgar in his tweed suit striding into the countryside. And you would see narrative painting still. You would not see the kind of advanced experimental art that Roger Fry was exhibiting, and you would be able to go to many more commercial galleries to look at art than you would have been able to 10 or 20 years before that. But what you would be aware of was this new tendency, this European style.
And Juliet Gardner, the novel has undergone some pretty dramatic changes in recent years, hasn't it? The three-volume novel has died, hasn't it, along with those Victorian circulating libraries. So fiction is sort of leaner and maybe a little bit meaner than it used to be.
Maybe it's leaner. Yes, I mean, Moody's circulating library, quite at the end of that, absolutely. And there are some very interesting novels actually published in 1909 and 1910. And a lot of them, of course, were were quite thinly veiled. I mean, they were quite thinly veiled polemics, or certainly debates about what was happening in society. I mean, things like E.M. Forster's Howards End or something like that, which was very much obviously concerned with class and with property. H.G. Wells's Tono Bongo was also published at this time, you know, with very much to do with kind of science and the proper role of science, and the new Machiavelli, which was, you know, to do with Fabianism and socialism and, you know, the role of the state in society. So, you know, they might have been leaner and thinner, but they were very relevant and very pertinent. But, of course, the best-selling novel of those times, it was actually The Broad Highway by Geoffrey Fernell. And though you can buy that online for 67p, I don't think many people know it today, and it is one of the great, I think, forgotten books of the period.
It does seem that many authors of this period have disappeared into obscurity, doesn't it? I mean, people like Max Pemberton is not read much now. He was at the top of the bestsellers charts in 1910, producing a kind of a strange brand of science fiction. I wonder why it is that authors from this period have suffered so much, have disappeared into the mists.
Well, possibly because at the time, I mean, H.G. Wells is still read, but I don't think anyone rushes to their copy of Walter de la Mare really anymore, but they do to T.S. Eliot. And it was, I mean, he wasn't published in 1910, but he was working on Prufrock then. Virginia Woolf was working on her new novel then. It didn't come out, I think, until the following year. But then also Rupert Brooke was writing his poems, and his first volume of poems was published the following year, 1911. So there's, again, you've got this sort of cusp of, I mean, Brooke writing, of course, these sort of immensely wonderful, patriotic, romantic, young man poems, cheek by jowl with Eliot writing these angst stuff that endures. So maybe it's because that new stuff is still so exciting and interesting to us that some of these other people have fallen by the wayside. But, you know, maybe they'll be back.
Yeah, I think that is really true. I think particularly within art history, what you have is Victorianism and modernism, and the Edwardians have sort of fallen somewhere in between these two great sort of monolithic periods of culture. And I think in the period at that time, around 1910, with the death of Edward VII, you do get some people within this kind of advanced culture saying, you know, the Victorians are dead. That grey-bearded morality, I mean, you have Freud writing now, and this sense of a different sexuality as much as a social life. The sense that the Victorians and the Edwardians, that's a generation that are just dispersed with now.
So in a sense, a lot of these works have, in effect, fallen down the crack in the sofa between
yes.
High Victorianism and modernism.
I think that's true. I mean, there is no Emily Bronte, there is no George Eliot. I mean, there are no great writers, women writers, certainly, I think. I mean, they're beginning to come online, obviously, like Virginia Woolf, but, I mean, it tends to be, you know, Marie Corelli and, you know, Mrs. Henry Ward and people like Humphrey Ward and people like that. Sorry, not Henry Ward, Mrs. Humphrey Ward. And people like... But I think what's interesting also is that we tend to forget, I mean, for example, to think of Kipling as being a very imperialistic, sort of jingoistic poet. In fact, what Kipling was writing about in 1910, in this period, was actually about England. I mean, he was writing The Road Through the Woods and things like that. And it's the same with Brooke. I mean, it's a sort of... There is a great concentration, it seems to me, on Englishness as a kind of retreat, if you like, perhaps, from some of the other writers.
But I wonder whether our sense that this, the literature, if this period is somehow inadequate, waiting for a big idea to come along, isn't a rather hindsighted position. I mean, you mentioned Mrs. Humphrey Ward. Mrs. Humphrey Ward was, her reputation is largely, Mrs. Humphrey Ward's low reputation, I would suggest, is largely the result of how mean Virginia Woolf was about her.
Yes.
And I wonder whether there isn't some broader historical process at
work
there.
And, of course,
there.
I mean, you know, it was Lytton Strachey's kind of version of the Victorians, of eminent Victorians, which we've inherited as well. I think it is, you know, very much a kind of retrospective view of this particular period and the way, of course, you know, the First World War comes as this kind of massive apparent break in, you know, that which went before it and that... which followed. So I think there is a kind of misunderstanding of the period.
And is there anything we can identify about the culture of this period that makes it distinctive, rather than just being this, you know, this kind of gap, this interstitial space, Lynn?
The thing that Max Pemberton, you mentioned, and Rudyard Kipling had in common was the motor car. And what they loved to do with this kind of elite machine was to drive out into the rural lanes of England and rediscover English history. So I think my kind of, you know, if I think about this sort of period of the Edwardians, I think of this kind of motor car and these incredible motorists driving into the English countryside.
I mean, Wind in the Willows is the perfect example,
yes.
Of course. Mr. Toad, Hong
yeah,
Kong,
absolutely.
Is the perfect thing, absolutely. No, I think that's right. I think it's very hard looking back because one does have this sort of golden bubble slightly.
OK, well, I want to round things off by asking you all for a work or a text or an aspect of the culture of 1910 that you think deserves to be rescued from obscurity. I'm going to pitch in with a little film called Tilly the Tomboy Visits the Poor, which is about two demonic schoolgirls from Walton-on-Thames who run amok through the town. And there's a fantastic end scene in this film where they go into this woman's house and she's there in bed, she's an old lady, and they come in and they rough her up completely. And then when they hear their pursuers at the door, they shove her back into the bed and pretend to be feeding her soup and reading the Bible to her. Lynn Mead.
OK, well, really I want to cheat and I want to put Dame Ethel Smythe's March of the Women next to Elgar so that you get that sense of the kind of what was going on during the period. But I suppose maybe an annotated catalogue to the 1910 Post-Impressionist exhibition, maybe by one of the people who were throwing up afterwards.
Julie Nicholson.
If I could time travel back to 1910, which is perhaps sort of a way to answer your question, I would give anything to nip over to Paris, which is a slight cheat, but he did come to London the next year, and see Nijinsky float onto the stage in L'après-midi d'un faune, because it was, I imagine, something amazing.
Juliet Gardner, what would you choose to revive?
I'm afraid mine's much more down to earth than Nijinsky. I'd like to bring back something called the Clarion. The Clarion was a newspaper which had been started actually at the very end of the Victorian period by Robert Blatchford. And it was kind of meant to explain socialism in sort of very simple terms. And it was extraordinarily popular. And it also it had a children's corner and a women's page. And it covered the arts and it covered the theatre and it covered literature as well. And it sold over 80,000 copies. And even though there was a mass media, obviously at this time, it was nothing like the mass media it has. So I think that the Clarion was almost a mass media. And over and above that, it covered cycling. And there were masses and masses of Clarion cycling clubs. And cycling clubs are really democratic. You could buy a second-hand bike for £2. You couldn't take a chaperone on your cycle. And you could get out into the countryside. So I'd like that, please.
OK. Well, it's time for us to stop the press now. There's just time, though, for you to thank our Women of the Year for 1910. Juliet Gardner, Juliet Nicholson and Lynn Deneed. Thank you.
I'd love to be in that time machine to see Nijinsky dance Debussy in Paris. This evening's Proms Literary Festival programme was presented by Matthew Sweet and produced by Lisa Davis. And back across the way here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on BBC Radio 3, I'm Andrew McGregor, and the audience here is awaiting the climax of Henry Wood Day, celebrating the founder conductor of his promenade concerts, which began back in the Queen's Hall in London in August 1895. This afternoon, there was Wood's own Last Night of the Proms programme from a century ago. This evening, the Ulster Orchestra and conductor Paul Watkins are bringing us music inspired by, premiered or championed by Wood himself. Ahead of us still are two works given their British premieres by Wood at the Proms, Sibelius's Corellia Suite and the Waltz and Polonaise from Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin, and between them, Sir Hubert Parry's Symphonic Variations. Sibelius's Corellia Suite was modern music, just 13 years old when Wood conducted it for the first time at a prom concert in 1906, but it was far from the first time he'd programmed Sibelius, starting out in 1901 with the King Christian II Suite, and Sibelius's first symphony 2 years later.
1906, in fact, turned out to be a very good year for Sibelius at the proms. In Saga, Finlandia twice, and that British premiere of Karelia. Then in 1907, would program Sibelius in no fewer than 12 proms. Karelia and Finlandia became more or less annual fixtures for a while. Well, the Karelia suite followed Sibelius's overnight success with his Kullervo Symphony in 1892. Finland's young musical nationalist seemed the obvious choice to write the incidental music for a student tableau at Helsinki University the following year, showing scenes from the history of the Finnish province, Karelia. There was a political edge to the production because of concern about the increasing Russianization of Karelia, and the idea was to put on a fundraising event to fund projects in the province to establish a college of education and to foster Finnish culture in a border region closer to St. Petersburg than to Helsinki. Sibelius knew the area and its folk music well, having spent his honeymoon there the year before, and after the success of the gala concert, when people were turned away from the packed hall, Sibelius reworked the music to leave four numbers, his Karelia Overture, and the suite of three pieces we're about to hear, beginning with the Intermezzo, music written to illustrate Karelian hunters paying their tributes to a Lithuanian duke as he levies his local taxes in a wintry landscape. The second piece is a ballade where the 15th century king sits in his castle with his retinue, listening thoughtfully to a minstrel's song. The march movement that ends the Karelia suite was played for a scene showing the siege of Kaukosalmi Castle in 1580, with the siege cannons laying waste to the town. The Ulster Orchestra's leader has just tuned them. He's Tamás Kocsis, and here to conduct them in Sibelius's Karelia suite is Paul Watkins.
Thank you.
The Karelia Suite by Sibelius, played by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins, 104 years after Sir Henry Wood gave the British premiere at a Queen's Hall Promenade concert. And Paul Watkins has just been getting the various sections of the orchestra to take their share of the applause. Horns first, then the trumpets. And we should mention the Ulster Orchestra's cor anglais player, Alison Alty, for that solo in the second movement. Well, just 4 days before Henry Wood first introduced Sibelius to his promenaders in October 1901, he gave the proms premiere of the piece we're going to hear next this evening, the Symphonic Variations by Hubert Parry. They might have played a part in inspiring a rather better-known set of symphonic variations by an English composer. Elgar is known to have admired Parry's piece and began his own Enigma Variations a year after Parry's. But the form is quite different. Elgar's are separate character portrayals. Parry's variations are grouped into four main sections and have much more of the unified feeling of a full-blown symphony, with an opening movement, scherzo, slow movement, and finale. Hence the title. The theme, by the way, isn't borrowed, and it doesn't bring with it a title or a subtext. It's Parry's own theme, a six-bar open-ended creation that allows every ending to become part of a new beginning. Parry was 49 when he wrote the piece, director of the Royal College of Music in London, the post he held there until his death in 1918, and there's none of the English pastoral tendency about the music. Parry's style owes its strength and resolution to classical and romantic German tradition. He was an admirer of Buxtehude, Beethoven, Brahms, and Wagner. Henry Wood didn't actually premiere this piece. It was written for a Philharmonic Society concert in 1897, but Wood took up the variations and adopted them for the proms, where they were heard six times between 1901 and 1936. And we're going to hear them again now, played by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins. Thank you. the Symphonic Variations by Hubert Parry, performed here at the Royal Albert Hall by the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Paul Watkins, who in his former life as principal cellist of the BBC Symphony Orchestra must have got to know another piece of Parry's music backwards at the Proms, Jerusalem, lustily performed as tradition dictates in the last night of the Proms, and it will be again this coming Saturday in Elgar's orchestration, although it isn't a Henry Wood innovation, it's a ritual ordained after his death. Well, that was a work Henry Wood premiered at a promenade concert in 1901. Wood conducted the first British performances of several Tchaikovsky scores, the Suite No. 3 and Manfred among them, and before the promenade concerts were even invented, Tchaikovsky's opera Eugen Onegin. He finished it in 1878. It had its first Moscow performance the following year, and 13 years later, Henry Wood, aged 23, conducted the first British production in English translation at the Olympic Theatre in London, which turned out to be a landmark moment for the young conductor. So it's hardly surprising that his affection for Tchaikovsky's score led him to programming the waltz from the opera at the Proms over 30 times, eventually pairing it with the Polonaise, both of which we're about to hear. Well, the waltz is from Tatiana's birthday party in the second act of the opera. The Polonaise is from a grand ball in a St. Petersburg mansion. And here comes Paul Watkins to conduct them both. Thank you. the Polonaise, and before it, the waltz from Tchaikovsky's opera Eugene Onegin, a favourite of Sir Henry Wood's ever since he conducted the first British performance of the opera in his early 20s. And those two items were to become regulars under his baton at the Promenade concerts. You've just heard them performed by the Ulster Orchestra, led by Tamás Kocsis, conducted by Paul Watkins. And Paul talked to me earlier about his change of role tonight, having played hundreds of proms as principal cellist of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and of course more than a few last night, now stepping where Sir Henry Wood stood before him on the podium. I asked him about this sudden change of perspective.
Well, the thing that struck me the most, and we rehearsed yesterday, was there's an incredible clarity of sound on the stage of the Albert Hall, and just being 2 feet higher up in the air, well, actually quite a number more than that, because if you think about where my ears were positioned sitting in the principal cello seat to where they are now standing on a podium that's a couple of feet high, you get a great overview of the orchestra. And I think actually the Albert Hall is a really easy place to balance an orchestra. I found it really thrilling, and I know the sound there and I recognise it very, very well, because it's really in my blood. And to be responsible for all of that sound yesterday for the first time was a really thrilling experience. You know.
Paul Watkins, and you could tell he was absolutely loving being on the podium in those two Tchaikovsky numbers with the Ulster Orchestra. Henry Wood's spirit will still be hovering over our Italian day at the proms tomorrow. 17th century Venice is brought to life for us at lunchtime by Le Poème Harmonique. The Royal Scottish National Orchestra brings us Berlioz's Roman Carnival and Respighi's Pines of Rome in the evening prom. And there's Paul Watkins back on the podium. The Ulster Orchestra is standing all around him. Cheers from the promenaders. That's two of our concerts tomorrow. The third is the late one, Italian arias, with the voices of Marie-Nicole Lemieux and Philippe Jaroussky at 10. But ladies and gentlemen, let us toast Sir Henry Wood, the self-taught conductor who premiered over 700 works by more than 350 composers, and without whose drive, dedication and enthusiasm we wouldn't be here at the proms at all. What a debt we owe him. Raise your glasses, and back in Broadcasting House, where the champagne's always on ice, here's Ian Skelly.
Always under lock and key as well, Andrew. Thank you very much indeed. That was Andrew McGregor at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. How fascinating that discussion during the interval about the mood of the times during the Edwardian period. It put the music we heard tonight into its proper context. Well, if you missed that or any of this afternoon's prom or tonight's, don't forget you can hear them all by going to the Radio 3 website and then following the links to the Listen Again page and the BBC iPlayer, bbc.co.uk/Radio 3. Back at the proms, as Andrew said, tomorrow night and at lunchtime. And after the lunchtime visit to Cadogan Hall, there's a chance to hear the prom given a week ago, yesterday, by the Minnesota Orchestra, when they performed under Osmo Vanska, the second of their two visits to the proms this year, in fact. Gil Shaham joined them to play Berg's Violin Concerto, and the evening ended with Beethoven's Choral Symphony, the number 9. You can hear that prom again tomorrow afternoon here on BBC Radio 3, beginning at 2. And what of the morning?
Breakfast on Radio 3. Breakfast on Radio 3, bringing music to life. Weekday mornings from 7 till 10 here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, back to tonight, and our next programme is Words and Music, an uninterrupted sequence of music, poetry and prose, this week on the theme of exile. That begins at 10:30. To take us there, we'll take a trip to Paris to hear the bells of the Church of Saint-Genevieve, as depicted by Marin Marais, played here by the Spectre de la Rose. Evocative music from 17th century Paris, the sound of the bells of the Church of Saint-Geneviève, as conjured by Marin Marais, who at the age of 23 became court composer to the King, Louis XIV, which meant that although he had to work for the King for 6 months of the year, the rest of his time was his own, free therefore to compose, teach and give plenty of private concerts.